Hi, everybody. This is Jenny. Welcome to Miami Lit Podcast. I have author Alex Segura today with me. How are you, Alex?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. I was just saying to you privately, I'm so excited to talk to you.
It's such a small today, world.
It really is. So I had no idea about your work until a mutual friend of ours, Corrine, recommended your new book, this one, the one we're talking about today, Secret Identity. And I said, like, oh my God, what? This is amazing. And he's from Miami, and it took off from there. So yeah, small world.
That was so funny. Yeah, we went to high school together, and she messaged me on Instagram, and she was like, you should be on my friend's podcast. And I said, sure. Yeah, it's a Miami podcast. Like, why not?
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Of course.
It's an honor and a pleasure to have you. So let's dive in into this, your new release, which I devoured. This was so good. Yeah.
Thank you.
So it's a novel just recently released. So probably a lot of people are not aware of it yet. So let's do like a little brief synopsis. Would you like to do the honors?
Happy to do it. Yeah. So Secret Identity is the story of Carmen Valdez, who's a Cuban American queer woman who moves from Miami to New York in 1975 to pursue her dream of working in comic books. She grows up reading comic books. It's a big bonding thing with her father. Once they come over from Cuba to Miami, and she gets a job as a secretary at this kind of third rate publisher called Triumph Comics. But her dream is to write comics. She's a fan. And so she keeps pitching her boss, who's this kind of blowhard type character, curmudgeonly publishing guy, Jeffrey Carlisle. And he basically says, look, I'm not going to give you an opportunity. I have a line of guys around the door that I have to keep fed with freelance, and it would just be weird for me to give work to my secretary. So definitely, you know, though he probably isn't aware of it, it's a very misogynistic attitude for him to have. So she feels defeated, but she's very driven, and she goes back home and is surprised to find one of her colleagues, this younger editor, Harvey Stern, pop up at her apartment and say, I've got this opportunity to write Triumph Comics' first female superhero. I got the assignment. I don't know what to do. I know you want to write. I'd love to collaborate with you. The only hitch is you have to do it anonymously, and eventually, you know, we'll tell Carlisle and get you the credit you deserve. But for now, we'll have to keep it a secret. And Carmen is very smart. You know, she sees the red flags and she's aware that this is not ideal, but she also is tempted the way I think anyone would be to pursue their dream. Like, you finally have your dream put in front of you. And so she agrees to do it. They brainstorm this character called the Legendary Lynx, who's kind of like a street level daredevil, like Batman type character that, you know, is a crime fighter in Triumph City, which is the fictional city of the Triumph superheroes. They write the comic. It's drawn by this legendary illustrator, Doug Detmer, and it becomes a huge hit. It becomes a massive hit for Triumph, which is a small company, and it starts getting attention. But in the meantime, her colleague Harvey is murdered, and all the scripts were turned in with only Harvey's name on them. So no one has any idea that Carmen was involved. And Carmen knows that if she mentions it to Carlisle, it's not going to end well. Like, she'll probably lose her job because she went around what he basically decreed, that she couldn't do this. So she takes the role of kind of amateur detective and tries to figure out what happened to her friend, because she's, you know, it's her friend, you know, a work friend, but still someone she cares about. And then to also reclaim this character that really meant so much to her. I mean, Carmen literally busts out notebooks and pages of inspiration she's been working on for years when they start brainstorming. So there's a lot of Carmen in the character. And throughout the novel, interspersed are actual sequences from the comic book. So you're reading Carmen's adventures in prose in a novel, and then you jump into the comic book, which are illustrated by Sandy Jarrell, who's a fantastic artist, and lettered by Taylor Esposito. And so they're kind of in meta conversation with each other. You read the prose, and then you hop into the comic, and you kind of see clues about what's going to happen in the novel. And and that's the big picture, Secret Identity.
I loved it. I love that the little snippets of the comics throughout.
Oh, cool.
That was so much fun.
Oh, and nice.
Yeah. And it threw in like a different element. It was very meta, like you said.
I'm glad it landed.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I actually wanted more. I was like, why aren't there more?
Yeah, we're
pages?
Working on the comic book. Yeah, we're going to do the comic book just as like a standalone thing, like making it feel really super meta, like something that was lost from 1975 that finally got republished.
Oh my goodness. That's so, so, so exciting. Okay. I have so many questions for you.
Yeah.
So let's start at the beginning. So what sparked these characters?
It's funny. Like for me, I start to build the pieces around the story. Like I knew I wrote this Private Eye series set in Miami, which is where I'm from. I'm Cuban American, starring this Cuban American private eye named Pete Fernandez, but he doesn't start off as a private eye. He like the whole story is about him deciding to become this private eye and overcoming his personal demons and kind of realizing what his quote unquote destiny is. So I wrote 5 of those novels. They got award nominations. They did pretty well. They were acclaimed, but I knew I had reached the end of that story. And then I wrote a Star Wars novel, Poe Dameron Freefall, which was a YA origin story of Poe, the Star Wars character. But around that time, I was thinking about what my next crime novel was going to be. And I'd always want the books that really speak to me in terms of crime novels are the ones that take you somewhere else, like a mm-hmm. different industry, a different place, a different point of view. The author that comes to mind that does it really well is Megan Abbott. Like she will write crime stories or noir stories and set them in these worlds that you wouldn't think noir even exists, like cheerleading or gymnastics or science. And she does it really well. And she really adheres to the idea of noir, which for me, it means someone is painted into a corner and they have to make really tough decisions. And then the story is about how they either make up for that bad choice or are penalized by that bad choice. And that to me is like the elements of noir, are the elements of noir. And so I knew I wanted to do a comic book noir. I knew I wanted it to be set in a different time to kind of contrast comic books today. Like today, comics are everywhere. You watch, right. I watched a Moon Knight show this weekend, which is crazy. Like when I was reading comics, Moon Knight, I mean, I'm still reading comics, but as a kid, Moon Knight was like a B or C level character. So now that he has a show, it's like all these, like every character is having a moment. But I wanted to show a time that was not like that, where people thought of comics as disposable, mm-hmm. as this kind of fringe industry looked down upon as not literary. Whereas today it's like, it's just another medium. It's just another way to tell a story. And dating even further back to my 20s, I went to FIU in college at FIU. I remember reading Michael Chabon's The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay and loving, I loved all his books. I read Mysteries of Pittsburgh. I read Wonder Boys, but Cavalier and Clay really spoke to me because it was set in comics in the Golden Age, which is like the 40s, the 30s and 40s, you know, that World War II era when comics really became major. And I loved the book. I loved how he wrote it, but I also wanted to read the comics. Like he wrote this great prose story about this character called the Escapist, but I wanted to read the comics of the Escapist as a comic fan. And they did that down the line. They eventually like created like the side product, but that idea stuck with me. And I also wrote a short story in an FIU creative writing class about an employee at a comic book company discovering this lost character. It wasn't the Lynx, but it was another character. And I remember that while I was working on this idea, you know, 20 years later, thinking about what to write next. And then Carmen showed up, you know, and I never thought that would happen again. Like with Pete, he just kind of popped up into my mind and I saw him right. completely. I saw like his flaws. I saw who he was. He reminded me of someone I knew. Like he just reminded me of someone I maybe hung out with in college or as an adult. And Carmen was the same. I mean, but she was from a different time, but I could see a lot of people I knew in her kind of blended together. And so once Carmen appeared, the story started to come to life. You know, you drop your characters into the setting and then you let them move around and then things happen. And that's when the idea of her creating this character anonymously really clicked. And that felt like such a meaningful mystery. Mm-hmm. The challenge with like an amateur detective is that it's not like a private eye where they will just get into trouble. They are going to do it because they feel like they're like this tainted knight and they have to be a hero. With an amateur PI, it's a person like you or me. Like what's going to drive me to investigate a murder? It would have to be something like really primal. And right. for Carmen, I think it had to be her idea being stolen, her creation being taken away and her seeing it. There's a turning point in the book and it's not really a spoiler where they run out of the scripts. They do the 6 scripts that Carmen wrote with Harvey. And then they start dishing the assignment out to like a hack writer and a hack artist. And she sees her idea being like twisted and taken away. And that's what really like makes her jump in and say, I need to figure this out. Yeah. And that's kind of the origin of Secret Identity.
She's quite a badass, obviously.
Well, good. Yeah. She's very driven.
She is. And when I first picked up the novel, I was like, interesting, you know, a woman superhero. Okay. Yeah, I guess we need those. But then when you start reading and getting to know her, it makes complete sense that she's a woman. There's no better way of telling this story than through her. Did that, how did that weigh on you as a writer?
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot in common. You know, she's Cuban American. We have similar backgrounds, but we're different. You know, I'm a straight man. She's a queer woman. She's in a different time. So, you know, I wanted to respect the idea, like the idea that popped into my head, and I wanted to kind of see it through, but I also knew I had to be thoughtful about it. I think a lot of writers, a lot of older writers push back and say, well, I should be able to write whatever I want and whoever I want from any point of view that I want. And I don't think anyone's saying you can't. I think the idea is you have to do the work. You kind of have to do the research. You have to talk to people. I had sensitivity readers that read that did share Carmen's life experience, you know, whether it was that they worked in comics at the time in the 70s or they were queer women that understood comics, or, you know, just to give me that context because I wasn't trying to tell her definitive experience in that space. You know, it's not my story to tell, but I wanted this character to kind of be seen through this story. And I felt it was important enough, but I had to do the work. And that's, you know, and I think doing the work means more than just saying I had a sensitivity reader. It means like taking the notes and changing the story to fit those notes. Because I think it's easy to say you passed your book along and somebody read it and kind of gave you, they checked the box. But I think I got notes, like people gave me feedback and said, this is, you know, you may want to change this or, and there was a lot of positive feedback, which is always reassuring that you're kind of doing it right or doing it justice. But you have to be open to feedback. And I also got a lot of notes just on the time period. I was born in 1980, so I didn't even know what happened in 1975 from a firsthand experience. But I was able to kind of research it and try to tell the story, and then have people who did live that experience say, well, no, this is how we got sales numbers, or you know, copy machines were like this back then. You know, things that you take for granted as you're writing a story, like, oh, she went to the copier and she printed it out. Somebody was like, well, the copier would probably smear ink on her hands. And I thought that was like those little nice touches of like detail that I think as a reader, maybe you just take for granted, but not take for granted, but just like you just assume that the author knew, but I didn't know because I wasn't there. And so having feedback and, you know, little notes like that, all of it was helpful and added to the texture of the story. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's a mystery. It's supposed to entertain, and it's about, that's what it's about. But I wanted every aspect of it to feel genuine.
And what about the crime fiction component to the story? Obviously, you are a pro at crime fiction with your background, but how is the experience integrating the two, your two loves, let's
My two
say?
passions. You know, it was a much smaller personal story as opposed to like the P. Fernandez books are character driven, but they're also very action, there's murders, there's cars exploding, there's shootouts. It's akin to kind of something like Reacher, maybe a little more character driven than that, but it's much more about there's action to a degree that you don't see in Secret Identity. Secret Identity is very atmospheric. It's more about noir and less hard boiled. It's about Carmen in her head. You spend The story is told from her perspective. You don't really hop around to anyone else's POV, which is different. And I wanted one thing I hate as a reader, and one thing I try never to do as an author is to not earn the mystery. You know, when I'm reading a book and you know it's a mystery, you know there's going to be a twist at the end, and then the twist doesn't pay off. Like you read the ending and it's like, oh, it was that character I read for like 2 seconds in chapter one, and they never show up again, and they're the killer. And then you just feel kind of like shortchanged. So I knew I had to have a twist that was meaningful. And even if as a reader you got it and you were like, oh, I knew it was that person, I wanted the journey to that point to be so interesting that you were okay with it. Because sometimes you know the mystery. Like I read a lot of mysteries, so I sometimes can figure out the twist. But if I'm enjoying the ride, it doesn't matter. Then I just appreciate that the mystery was earned. And so that was the big challenge to like, what is going to pull Carmen in to becoming this amateur PI without making it too much of a grisly, like shoot 'em up? Like, there's one murder, there's some violence, but it's very much kind of a psychological crime story.
I agree with that. I feel like as a fan of that genre, it's the journey's definitely worth a lot more than the big reveal, you know? Because sometimes that big reveal can be so grandiose that it's a letdown too at the same time.
Yeah, and then it becomes like, yeah, no, totally. And then it becomes like the twist upon the twist, which is sometimes fun. Like if you're reading like a nice a thriller and you want to keep the pages turning and you want that twist. And I wanted that in this book, but I didn't want it to just be about the twist, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And you achieved that wholeheartedly.
Oh, good.
It was
good.
Yeah.
I'm glad because you were surprised.
The journey was definitely what took certain center stage and everything that she just has to go through, you know, like if you think, well, she's a woman, she's of an immigrant background, and for her to just show up in New York and say, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to be a secretary and I'm just going to go for it and see what happens. That says a lot about her.
Yeah. She's strong. She's strong-willed. Yeah. She's a great character. I mean, I'm not saying that because I created her. I'm saying it because she's fun to write.
But sometimes
she is. Your characters like come to life and you like just follow them around with your notebook. But she is very driven. She's very different from Pete, who is, you know, by the end of the series, he is discovered his path. But Carmen knows her path from like page one. Like this is what she's going to do. This is what she wants. And it's never in a like, she's just focused. She's strong. She's strong-willed. She's driven. But she's also like all of us. You know, has her flaws and has her weak points like we all do.
Yeah, for sure. So we briefly touched upon the fact that she's of Cuban descent.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I really enjoyed about the novel is how many different layers you put in there. You know, it's not, you think it's a comic? Well, no, it's a novel. You think it's just a novel? Well, no, it's a crime fiction. And there's just so many treats for the reader.
Oh,
as
good.
Far as how, you know, like so many avenues that you could take. And I want to start off with immigration,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's such a big part of who she is. She's Cuban. How important was it to you to really make sure that was in there, palpable to the reader?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason I started writing the Pete books, not to make this about Pete, but the reason I wrote that book, the first book, was because I never saw any books where the protagonist was Cuban American or had that background. And I think as readers, identification is so important. When you see yourself in a character, even if it's a partial identification, you feel seen and included and part of. All the PI novels I read, it was usually an ex-cop. It was usually like a white man, which is fine. It's not a criticism. It's just, I didn't see myself anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so it felt really important to me subconsciously. I didn't realize that I did it for that reason until much later, but subconsciously I wanted to read a character that had my experiences. And I think I'll always write about Miami, even if the novel is set somewhere else. Like, you know, I knew I wanted to write a New York novel, but it made sense for Carmen to be from Miami because those are the characters I write. I want to see more of that in fiction and I want to be part of that, you know, expression. And I think when you're doing that, you have to think about why you're doing it. And part of it was to just show that story, because I don't think a lot of people know about that story outside of Miami or outside of like Cuban culture. And that's kind of why we didn't italicize the Spanish. Like that's like, sometimes mm-hmm. I feel like when you italicize Spanish, like you're forcefully overemphasizing it. Like you're almost like doing it like you're overemphasizing it, whereas it's just how she talks, like with her family. Like they just speak Spanish right. to each other and it should be treated naturally. And it's never so much that someone who doesn't speak Spanish won't understand what's happening. But I also didn't feel the need to like over explain it. Like, you know, sometimes you'll read it in Spanish italicized and then the next line is like a direct translation. And it's like, I mean, readers are smart. They'll figure it out what it means. Like they can read, you know, like you can take a little detour and experience like Cuban culture and you'll be okay. Like that's kind of what I wanted. I wanted to give readers a sense and a peek into this because it's part of who I am and it's part of a lot of people I know. And so it felt like the right way to do it.
Right. That was a really nice surprise to read those lines in Spanish. And like you mm-hmm. said, they're just in there. They just exist and there's no explanation. And it makes complete sense for them to be in the story.
Well, because they're just in there for us. Like when we speak Spanish to our families, like exactly. I don't put on a different voice when I'm speaking in Spanish. It's just,
right.
I'm just speaking in Spanish. And so it didn't need that little asterisk or italicized. Yeah. Didn't need to be italicized.
I thought it was so great the way you did that because it's just enough to show the flavor of the culture, but it's not so much that a non-Spanish speaker would be like, well, you know, I don't understand. Why is this here? So that balance was perfect.
Oh, good. Yeah. You want to give them a peek into what it's like. And I wanted Carmen's a three-dimensional character. She's got about, you know, I wanted people to see her background and kind of the things that made her who she was. Like, we're all products of our childhood. We're all products of where we come from and how we're raised. And I wanted to show that. I think that's important.
Right. I think what you did takes the idea of comic books being multicultural to a different level, because we've seen that recently with especially the films coming out and shows, how they're really trying to do that. But I hadn't seen it like this, not the way you did it.
Okay.
What do you hope to see in the future of comics?
I mean, in comics and in crime fiction and in literature, right. I think it's just, we need to have people telling the stories they want to tell. And I think, especially when it's like marginalized voices, I think the trend is sometimes to expect these writers, and that includes me, to tell your trauma, like tell stories about your trauma. Mm-hmm. And I want to see stories that are not based in trauma. I want to see, like, you know, there's a Cozy series by this writer, Raquel Reyes, who's Cuban American and lives in Miami. And a Cozy is like a lighthearted mystery. And I loved seeing that. And it's about Miami. It's about like Cuban coffee. Like, it's just got, it's funny. It's lighthearted. And it's not about just being, you know, it's part of her character, but it's not about the trauma right. of that, you know, like, and I think it's important to just show these characters doing things in every kind of genre, whether it's lighthearted, whether it's dark noir or action or science fiction or fantasy, like just mix it up. And I think it's important to not push these writers to only speak from trauma, because I think there's other stories to be told. And I think that's the next step. Like, you know, it's great that, you know, literature is diversifying and we're seeing new voices telling their own stories, like from their perspectives, but you know, there's more to it. You know, it's about inclusion and representation. And I think people need to be mindful of that. It shouldn't just be on the marginalized writers to remind people to be mindful of that.
Yeah, you even bring up Celia Cruz in the in the novel.
I love that song.
Her dad calls her Carmencita, which was so fun to read. It reminded me of
Que Pasa Carmen. USA.
Yes, the Carmen from Que Pasa USA.
Yeah.
So there's a lot in there that you throw in that really shows Cuban heritage.
Oh, good.
And just Hispanic heritage as a whole, I would even say. Mm-hmm. Do you think her background added to her the strong determination she has as a person? The strong determination she has as a character, as a person, do you think?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I could relate a lot to Carmen moving. I mean, I did the same journey just at a different time in a different way. Yeah. I moved from Miami to New York to work in comics, and I could really relate to that and really, really, you know, we shared that experience and just that idea of being driven and kind of, you know, how do you say it? You know, your parents work so hard to get here, and they work, your grandparents work so hard to get here. They uprooted themselves to leave this country so you would have a better life. And then the onus is kind of on you to earn out, you know, to show that you, you're worthy of that effort, that kind of huge effort to like take your, you know, take everything that was important and leave it behind just to like survive. And so I think Carmen feels that to some degree too. Like, and it's not like literal. She doesn't say, oh my God, I have to do this because my parents came over. It's just ingrained in, it's just like a, you know, it's instinctual. Yeah. Like you have
There's
to work harder.
There's a grit that you have, right? When you come from that kind of background, not just Cuban, but any immigration background, right? That becomes ingrained in you.
And you just know, like, you work hard, and you know that you see your parents working hard, you see your grandparents working hard, and you know that you have to kind of carry that torch. Like you're the first, you know, sometimes the first generation is the first generation to go to college in the United States, the first generation to like get a degree or, you know, get a job outside of like, you know, other industry. You know, it's hard, but there's that weight and that, but it's not a bad weight. I think it motivates you.
Yeah, absolutely. I would, I agree with that wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. Carmen's dad learns to read English through reading comic books, which and you mentioned this briefly a little bit ago, how for a long time comics had this reputation of not being literary enough, you know, it was that thing you read and you didn't really, you know, you kind of outgrew because you had to become smarter or whatever, but right now we see a lot of kids struggling with reading, picking up a book, the literacy levels are dropping. Would you advise parents to encourage their kids to pick up comic books?
I think whatever gets kids reading is a good thing. You know, my son reads comics and he's starting to read, and he loves, like, you know, Archie comics, Calvin and Hobbes, and, you know, whatever you put in front of him, he like will read it. And I think that mixture of pictures and words is so powerful. For me, when I started reading, I read a bunch of Archie comics or like, you know, Donald Duck comics and things like that, because that you see the pictures and it connects to the words and it teaches you like a whole different kind of narrative. And I'm of the mind that if it gets them reading, like whatever works, you know, because reading is such a doorway into so much. Like I keep telling my son, I'm like, I'm so excited you're reading, because like it's a game changer. It was for me. Like when I started reading, the world opened up. Like I could read and learn all these things, like sit and read the encyclopedia, even if I was bored,
yeah.
Like just to kind of like learn. Your brain is a sponge. And so the sooner you can kind of get that started, the better, I think, with kids.
I agree. Yeah.
It's my perspective.
Right. No, but it's a great person, and it comes, obviously your opinion has weight because you're an author. So hopefully it can help parents. Cause I do know that there's that concern of, is what they're reading beneficial? Is it good enough? When I feel like the question should be, are they reading?
Exactly. I mean, is what I was reading as a kid beneficial? Like I read The Godfather, which is not a kid's novel, when I was like 8 or 9. Like maybe that was not the best idea. It's such a good book. It taught me so much about like dramatic structure. Yeah. Like, you know, when Sonny gets shot at the toll booth, I was like, oh my God, like that, you can do that. You can completely surprise the reader and take the character off the board. Because when you read the book, and I'm talking about the book, the movie is different. The movie is beautiful and like very like elegiac and very like royal and, you know, serious. But the book is a pulp novel. It's like a gritty crime novel. It's like sex, violence, all this stuff. And you read
not
it.
Not for a 9-year-old.
Yeah, not for, no. But when you read it, you think Sonny is the main character. You think Sonny is going to become the Don and he's going to be the star. And then he gets killed. I'm not spoiling anything. It's like a 60-year-old book. So it's,
yeah,
you know, like,
no.
You know,
and
if
I
you
feel
haven't
like
read
it's
it,
one of those where even if you've watched the movie and you've read the book, you pick it up and it's still so exciting to go down that path.
And it taught me like that power of the surprise and of the twist and of building up characters and like narrative structure. I didn't understand that yet. I was just like, oh my God, you can do that. You can like pull the rug out from a reader like that. And to your point, like, yeah, as long as they're reading, I think it's, you're on the way. Like whatever, there's so many distractions today. Like, you know, they could be, you know, screen time is ever present. I'm not saying don't show them screens, but it's like anything that gets them reading is a win.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
1,000%, if that's even possible.
Yeah, yes.
So Miami and New York are almost like two other characters in the novel. They play a crucial role in as the backdrop for Carmen and what she's going through. And you contrasted them fairly, not just accurately, but in such a way that I hadn't really considered.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you just said that you experienced that yourself in your own personal life. How was that transition going from Miami to New York City?
It's funny because I feel like everyone that is born or raised in Miami reaches a point where they're exhausted with Miami and they're like, I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to do something else. I'm going to go away. And when I moved to New York, it was exciting. I was in my 20s. I was excited. You're in the big city. But it was also really lonely. It's like, it's this great, like, you know, concrete jungle, to use the cliche, but it's also like you're surrounded by people, but it's also very lonely. You're kind of by yourself. You don't know anyone. I was starting a new job, making new friends, but there's still those moments where you're like, I miss home. I miss the connection. You miss the weather. I mean, you miss the food. You miss the knowing culture. Like, you know, the Cuban culture is not in the minority in Miami. It is kind of a powerful part of the city's culture. Whereas in New York, that's when I kind of first realized I was other, you know, like, you know, you're not,
that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. It was an interesting experience to be like, okay, so you're not in the majority here. And that's fine. It's just like, you just start to kind of realize your place, not your place. That sounds weird, but you start to realize that you're part of a bigger world. And that can be, you know, I was homesick. And so I wanted to show that in the book, like how homesick Carmen could be and how she was becoming nostalgic for the things she had left behind, things that she probably didn't expect to be nostalgic about. Because I didn't expect it when I moved. I thought, okay, I'm going to go do this. And, you know, Miami will always be there. And Miami continues to change. And so, yeah, I wanted to show that contrast of Miami as home, this kind of idyllic home that she has in her mind, and New York, this very gritty and dangerous and menacing present that she still loved too. She's still excited to be there. She still loves how unpredictable the city is, the opportunity that the city provides. And so I tried to kind of balance it, not with one being good or one being bad, but just like they're so different.
Right. I wonder, could Carmen have written her comic in Miami? No way, right? Like, that's not possible.
No, there was just the comic book publishing industry was based in New York at the time. I think today she could. Like, I think comics as an industry are worldwide now. You have artists all over the world who just, you know, they email their pages. Yeah, you know, now she could. It's totally different. But I think at the time in 1975, publishing was just locked into New York. It was, and if you didn't live in New York, you didn't really get that same access. Like, maybe it could work, you know, but it would have been much harder.
Right. That makes sense. So Carmen can only achieve her dream of being a writer as a ghostwriter for Harvey. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the Lethal Lynx would have been possible with Carmen as just her as the writer without Harvey?
I don't think it would have been impossible. I think she was in a particularly challenging situation where her boss basically was playing defense, though not, you know, Carlisle's not the villain per se. He's just like not a great person, but he has moments where you feel some empathy towards him. Like, you know, he's flawed. And that's one of his flaws, that he's not giving her this opportunity. But, you know, I spoke to a lot of women that did work in comics, like Linda Feit, who wrote this comic called The Cat for Marvel. And she worked in the Marvel bullpen, and she was able to write this character, and she became the first woman to write a female superhero at Marvel, which was huge, and other great professionals. So the path was not like completely blocked at the time. I think Carmen just particularly hit a rough path.
Right. Which was very common from what I can see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And the way he tells her, you know, it's almost like my hands are tied. I can't.
Yeah. He was like, what can I do?
You
like,
can't be a writer.
Yeah. I have other plans for you, which to me was the turn. Like, when I really, like, you can tell his intentions are kind of good, but the idea that it's his right to plan her career is presumptuous and not great.
Right. Yeah. And I'm sure that still goes on today.
Mm-hmm.
In many different ways, not just for writers. So the lynx, why a lynx?
That's another
easy to decide upon.
It was a character that I had from forever ago I remembered the name, the lynx, and I was like, that's a cool superhero name. And I of course like researched it, and it didn't exist, and I thought, well, why come up with, I knew I needed a character. I needed a character to be in the comic sequences and to kind of echo Carmen, but also not be Carmen. Like, I didn't want people to read the lynx and think, oh, it's just Carmen as a superhero. Mm-hmm. Like, Claudia Gala is a whole different person, but also there's parts of Carmen, and the way every character somebody writes has a part of you, of the writer in them. And so I used that name, and then I reached out to Sandy, the artist, and I said, this is what I'm doing. I've written X amount of the book. I've outlined the rest. And there are these sequences, these comic book sequences. Do you want to be a part of it? Like, that's the collaborative part of the book, was, you know, kind of jamming with Sandy and Taylor to create those comic sequences. And then he came up with the design for the Lynx that felt like very of the time, but not cheesy. You know, like, it felt very 70s and comic booky, but not like, not a parody. I didn't want him to imitate. I wanted him to evoke the time and make it feel like, you know, if you're a comic reader and you're reading this book, you could say, wow, I could believe that this happened at the time.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the big idea.
That's so, so cool. The art is so, so nice. I mean,
yeah, he did a great job. He's really, and the thing about Sandy is that he's not just a great artist, but he like understands comic book history and really gets like the style of the time without, like I said, without imitating it. So we would have this shorthand. I'd say, okay, in comics, there's two ways to write a comic. You can either write it full script where it's like a screenplay and the artist just draws like panel, basically what you tell them to, or something that they call Marvel style, where it's a little bit looser and the artist gets to decide the panel breakdown. And then the writer comes in and does the script over those panels. So we did it that way, because I wanted him, I mean, he's the artist. He knows better of what, you know, better in terms of what visually it's going to need as the director of kind of the movie. So I would send him like a short paragraph. I'd say, okay, this will be like 3 pages. It'll open up with the Lynx jumping over some rooftops. Then she'll throw a star and catch the guy. She'll interrogate him. And we close on a close-up shot of her surprised. Because I knew what was going to happen. I just didn't have the dialogue and the captions. And then he would do a rough layout And I would script over that, which just meant like I would come up with the captions, the sound effects, the dialogue, and then he would finish it up and tighten up the artwork and Taylor would do the letters. But it felt a lot more organic that way and it felt a lot more creative. And, you know, sometimes he would come back and say, it works better this way, or maybe we can try this. And, you know, he'd show me designs and we'd go back and forth on designs. Like he designed Mr. Void, who kind of looks like this evil David Bowie villain, which was cool. And the Voidoids, those like skeleton creatures, which I thought were super creepy.
So he designed those?
Yeah.
Oh, that is cool.
Yeah. These, and that was all, you know, all the work that went into those little pages, like those 14 pages, was the same work that you would put into a regular comic book. So
yeah,
that's why after the book was done, I was like, we should just do the comic. Like we've got all the work. The work is done. Now we just need to kind of write the comic. But
now I get it.
Yeah.
Okay. That's so you guys definitely, like, you wrote two different things at the same time. And then
yeah.
Wow.
Exactly.
Wow.
Which was fun.
Impressive. I can imagine, like, creatively for all of
really
you
cool.
involved.
Yeah, and he's a great collaborator, just one of the nicest guys.
Yeah. Was it the first time that you worked that way with someone?
It was the first time we worked together. I mean, I've written comics with other artists and written in that style, like where it's a little bit looser and kind of let the artist drive. If I know the artist, I feel comfortable like letting them do that because I know what they can do. I've known Sandy a long time and he's done some work for me like at Archie and other places, but we'd never worked together as a writer and artist. So this was really cool. A cool way to kind of launch that collaboration.
What a way. My goodness.
Yeah, it worked out really well.
you guys set the bar really high.
I hope so.
Yeah, for sure. So let's quickly talk about Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
So Harvey.
Oh, Harvey. Yeah.
Oh, Harvey. He at first he seems kind of harmless.
Yeah.
You know, he's just this guy who seems like he really needs attention, has something to say, but
you feel bad for him.
Say it. Yeah, that's what it is. You feel bad for him. And then contrasted with Carmen, who's this go-getter and she knows exactly why she's there and what she needs to do. When he approaches her with that proposition of being his ghostwriter, you're almost like, okay, I mean,
you trust him.
It's fine. Like what could go wrong?
Right.
You know? So
yeah,
how was creating Harvey
for you? You know, the thing with all the characters, with all the supporting characters, is that I didn't want them all to feel like archetypes. Like I didn't want Carlisle to just be like this J. Jonah Jameson type, or Harvey to be like the nebbishy, like guy pining for Carmen, or Molly to just be the funny roommate. Like I wanted to add layers of depth to them and complicate them. And I think Harvey was the most interesting because, like you said, he starts off as this harmless guy that she's friendly at work and she's kind of like pushing off his advances, like very, like she's not threatened by him. But then as you start to kind of peel back the layers, you see that there was much more going on. And what Harvey did was not as innocent, without spoiling anything, was not as innocent as you first think. Like he isn't just saying, oh, look at this great opportunity. Like, let's work on it together and eventually I'll take care of you. And that's the heart of the mystery. You start to realize that there's more to what Harvey was doing and there's a reason why he did it the way he did it. And that conflict really affects Carmen because she at first is like, oh, what happened to my friend? And then she feels betrayal, but also sadness that he just got caught up with that. Like there's a real sense of entitlement to how he acts, like this expectation that he should get what he wants, even though he hasn't done the work. And Carmen has done the work and she does get what she wants, but nobody knows that she did it. And that to me is like the crux of their dynamic.
It definitely shows it's a microcosm of what relationships would have been like, right?
Mm-hmm.
Without assuming too much.
Yeah.
But it seems like it's the normal dynamic of the day, of the times.
Yeah, it just seemed like he, instead of, you know, if he got this opportunity and instead of being like, well, I'm going to do the work, I'm going to figure it out and I'm going to do a great job and it's going to be great. He's like, what's the shortest path from A to B? You know, what's the easiest way to do this? Oh, I'll just talk to Carmen. And obviously there's more to the mystery. As you read the book, you realize that there was much more going on with why he did it that way. But whereas Carmen has been working on this character since she was a kid, like this is her goal and she's been working toward it. And I wanted to show that. That's my favorite scene early on where they're brainstorming And she's like, she busts out those notebooks and those pages. And she's like, this is my shot. And I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to lose my opportunity. Yeah. Like, this is what I've wanted this whole time. And meanwhile, on the other side of the coin, Harvey's just trying to wing it. He just wants to get the credit and the acclaim. He doesn't really want to do the work as much.
It doesn't mean as much to him.
Right.
So when she busts out those notebooks, you're excited for her, but at the same time, it's like, no, Carmen, no.
Yeah, don't give it all away.
Yeah.
Wait, don't wait just for a better opportunity. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But but that's the noir part of it. Like, you get you're tempted by the opportunity, like this thing you've always wanted, even though it's like a devil's bargain, because if you do it, you're losing it. And that was kind of the heart of the book.
Exactly. Yeah, it's up. She definitely, I probably would have done the same in her situation, to be honest.
I think so too. Yeah, I would have done it. I mean,
you know, because would you wait? I don't think a lot of
people. I think part of it is who she's reeling, still reeling from that conversation with Carlisle. So you go from her talking to Carlisle and he basically says, no, this is never happening for you here. Yeah. And so everything she's done to that point is now meaningless. Like, she's moved to this new city. And then she has a venting session with Molly, her roommate, and then Harvey shows up with exactly what she thought was gone in front of her. And so it's, I think that balances out and makes her more prone to saying yes.
Exactly. Yeah. It's what I think it's safe to say we all would have said yes to Harvey.
Like, yeah. I would have, I can't speak for everyone, but I think it's a very tempting offer.
Right. Definitely. How was the research for this book? Because there's quite a lot in there.
It was fun. You know, I hate to even call it research. It was just like kind of being obsessed with something, which was a lot of fun. It wasn't really like, I got to interview people that worked in comics at the time, friends that I've known for a long time, people that worked in comics, read the manuscript and kind of marked it up and noted things that didn't really, you know, like the copier story or like how sales numbers came in or, you know, the kind of glue that they used in the production, like little details that maybe a casual reader would gloss over. But like, if you're a comic fan and you read that, you're like, okay, he did his homework, which is nice. But I also wanted to read about, it's a different comic book industry. It's a different time. Like, you know, now we have comic book shops, we have comics are on TV in the movies. Back then it was, you went to the newsstand. Mm-hmm. If your comic wasn't there, you weren't getting it. Like, there was no, like, you couldn't find a back issue on eBay. You couldn't, like, you know, maybe your friend had that Spider-Man issue you didn't get because you didn't get to the newsstand on time. But there was no comic conventions, really. There were like little events, like you see one in the book where she goes to this like hotel ballroom and there's people selling comics, but it's not like the huge pop culture thing that's happening now, which is great. Like, the awareness is so high. But I really wanted to evoke that. So I spoke to a lot of creators that worked in comics at the time just to get stories and anecdotes, like the volleyball game. Those really happened. Marvel and DC would play volleyball games in Central Park every week. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be cool if Triumph was in one of those games? Or there's one line where Carmen is talking about a colleague who threw a cherry pie at a production person. Like, that's a real story. Like, somebody I spoke to told me that story. Really? And he was like, I almost got fired. Oh, and I was like, goodness. I need to use that. Yeah. And there's one point where Carlisle is talking to somebody at the convention and he's telling the story about being at a party that he thought was for comic book people. And it was really like adult actors. And that's an actual story. Like, somebody told me, like, being at this crazy party. And so stuff like that, like, I obviously tweak it a little bit. So it's not, you know, you're changing it for fiction. It's a fictional story, but there's elements. I wanted that verisimilitude. I wanted people to read it and be like, oh, this could have happened. And, you know, another thing is there were these legendary poker games between like the editors, big editors at Marvel and the big editors at DC. And that's a plot point in the book. Like, Carlisle's like, oh, he's playing poker with Len and Marv, and Harvey came. And so I'm not saying it like in extreme detail, like spelling it out, but if you know comics, you're like, oh, okay, that's what he's talking about. And it's just like a little wink and a nod. Yeah. So
I really enjoyed the way you threw in little things like that about the comic book world that I would have never really known unless, you know, I came across them in like in this format. But it didn't feel like it was a by the way, you know, lecture right. type of thing.
I didn't want it to be like a Wikipedia entry. Yeah,
exactly. It felt so natural, and the way it was ingrained within the story that Carmen was really going through all these things. This was her life, you know.
I'm glad you noticed that. Yeah, I wanted it to feel like it's just what's around. Like, even when she's talking about comic book creators,
it wasn't
like
a history lesson,
right? Basically. When you, if you and I are talking about authors, I'm not like, oh, you know, Jim Lee, artist on Batman and the X-Men, who is from such and such a place. Like, you don't go into like bio, you're just talking about it. You're like, oh, I really like that issue of X-Men that he drew. You know, you just, it's, there's a shorthand, and I wanted it to feel that way when they're talking. There's only one moment in the book where it becomes a little bit of a history lesson, but that's because it literally is a history lesson when Berger is telling her about like Batman and these creators and why they're important. So that was the only time I kind of veered from that, but that actually was the point of his speech. Like, he's trying to share that info with her, whereas other times they're just, they're in it. So they're just talking about stuff that they know.
That was actually one of my favorite parts.
I love that part. Yeah. Oh, good.
Yeah. I love that part. Well, I am partial to Batman. So,
yeah, Batman's cool. Yeah. I love Batman. I love that care, that story too. And it was, and I just wanted to have a little nod to those creators as well.
It was, yeah. So it was such a treat because obviously, like, when you pick up the novel, you realize, okay, there's a comic book component to it. Mm-hmm. But to gain all that history and all that access to what that world was like in the 70s, it's amazing. I really, really enjoyed that.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I want to talk to you a little bit about you deciding to become a writer.
Okay.
So you mentioned you went to FIU, my alma mater as well.
Yeah.
Such Golden a good Panthers. School, yeah. For sure. When did you decide, okay, this is what I want to do?
That's a great question. I think I always wanted to tell stories. Like, as a kid, I would always like draw my own comics or write my own stories. I think as a kid, you never really know, like, oh, this will be my job. Like, you know, you also want to do other things. Like, I wanted to be president. Like, there's things that kids like just want to dream about. But I always drew and wrote. And, when I got to college in high school, I went to Southwest High. I was very involved in like the newspaper and the yearbook and stuff like that. And, so journalism started to kind of make sense because it felt like a craft. Like, I could use my skills as a writer to have a career. And so then in college, I got into journalism, but I was still an English major. I still love stories and storytelling. So, you know, on one side, I was doing journalism, like working at the school paper. On another side, I was taking classes about creative writing, like short stories or novels and things like that. So I always had those two things going. So journalism just felt to me like a more workmanlike way of telling stories. And I liked it. I was a reporting intern and then an editor, but I always wanted to tell stories. So I think there was no moment where I was like, I'm going to be a writer. I think it was just something that I always knew I wanted to do in some way. And then once the opportunity arose, I was able to like seize it, you know, and you try, as a writer, you just don't know. Like, I tried writing stories. I tried writing novels. I tried writing like the Great American Novel in college, like, which it was just like a bad ripoff of the Great Gatsby. I'm so glad that doesn't exist. Like, I remember sending it to a friend of mine who was a professor at FIU. And he was like, you know what, this is a nice first try. Like, but this is probably not something you want to like publish yet, but we have to go through those things to like, learn your voice. And I think for a long time, I wanted to be like this literary writer, which is fine. But then I also really love genre fiction. I love crime fiction. I love science fiction. I love, you know, like fantasy and things like that. So once I started reading a lot of crime fiction in my 20s, that's when I realized that was kind of the space for me.
I love crime fiction. I know
you can say a lot about society. You can say so much, you know, in crime fiction. It like sheds this light on our world in a way that I think a lot of other genres can't.
Right. It's limited in other places where in crime fiction, you really can go for it and you really can explore the underbelly of what's going on.
Yeah.
In a way where you can really pinpoint things. I feel like. Yeah.
Totally.
And I know that some people are hesitant to crime fiction just because they feel like it's not a space they want to escape to.
Right.
What makes it enjoyable for you?
For me, it's the characters. I always start as a storyteller, I start with character. If the characters are not interesting, then the story doesn't matter. Like, if I don't care about the people, I'm not going to care about the plot. And that is how I am as a reader. If I'm reading a story that is very plot driven, which is great, but the characters are like cutouts and it just like, they feel generic, I'm just going to check out. I'm just like, not as interested. I love the twist if I care about the characters. And so, the best crime fiction, like I was saying, you know, takes you somewhere else, but it's also the characters are really compelling and you care. They're complicated. They're flawed. They make mistakes. You know, I want to read about people who are struggling and what is their journey and what's the arc, you know, with my PI series, I wanted to make sure that at the end of a book, Pete was never the same as when you started. you know, he had to go through an arc, and then there's the arc of all the books. And so that's what interests me as a reader, like characters evolving and changing and becoming either getting closer to what they want to be or not. And that's interesting. And crime fiction does that really well. Like they're not the best crime fiction stories aren't afraid to show people like kind of warts and all, like all their flaws, which is interesting to me.
For sure. I feel the same way. For me, it's a place where you can really explore a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Character, plot,
setting, you know, yeah.
Setting, and it's never going to be, I don't want to say boring, but you're going to get something out of it.
You're learning no something and you're getting a fun story. Hopefully the best crime fiction, like you learn something about a different part of the world or a different type, you know, different people, different cultures. And, but you're also having a fun time, an entertaining time.
Who's your favorite crime fiction writer?
Oh, wow. There's so many.
I know that. No. I feel like that's such a loaded question.
No, it's good. I can, you know, in terms of like the ones that got me into writing, like I read a lot of like, Raymond Chandler, Jim Thompson, Laura Lippman, George Pelicanos, Dennis Lehane, Megan Abbott. I really like Michael Connelly. He's just a great like plotter and writer. Margaret Millar, Ross McDonald. There's so many. I could probably give you a list of 10 different names each time. But and there are a lot of new voices that I admire, like Sean Cosby and Kelly Garrett and Amina Akhtar and people that are just telling different kinds of crime stories that, you know, are compelling and interesting.
What are you reading now? Are you reading anything?
Yeah. What am I reading? My to read pile. I just finished this book called Things We Do in the Dark, which is a great thriller by Jennifer Hillier.
I love that book.
It's so good. She's so talented. What else have I read? I'm reading this book called An Honest Living by Dwyer Murphy, which is like, it feels like a, you know, like one, a classic, just a classic crime novel, like, and he did a great job. And Kismet by Amina Akhtar, which is fantastic. And it's
that I have not read.
It's a fun thriller set in the Sedona wellness industry. She did this book called Fashion Victim, which was set in the New York fashion scene. And it was like really sharp and funny and dark. And this is like that her voice has gotten so much better and stronger. Not that Fashion Victim was great, but this is like the next level. And it's really, really great.
You can see the evolution of her writing.
Yeah. I love that too. When you see a writer like really level up.
Right. Who is your favorite superhero?
Who is my favorite superhero? Spider-Man was my first superhero. I mean, I love Batman and I love the X-Men, but Spider-Man was the first comic I bought with my own money was a Spider-Man comic. And I remember one of the first comics I got was a Spider-Man comic that my grandparents bought me at Extra. Remember Extra, that supermarket?
Yes. Oh my God. Yes. There was an remember Extra.
I think there was an Extra on Coral Way. I think like opposite. I used to live, my grandparents lived in Westchester, so off 29th Street in Galloway. And there was an Extra right on Coral Way, I think. And so we would go there and they picked up this digest comic of Spider-Man. And I probably should not have been reading that because it was really scary, but I read it and I really liked it. And that kind of made Spider-Man my guy.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny.
Yeah.
Extra. I completely forgot about that.
I was right across the street from Columbus and St. Brendan's.
Right. Yeah. That's funny. Did you watch the new Batman movie?
Not yet. I'm not really going to theaters yet. I mean, we have our daughter's not vaccinated yet, so we're kind of like in a ton of like stuff like that. I mean, if it was just me alone in the theater, maybe, but I want to see it, but it's also 3 hours long, which
that's how we did it.
We had
like the morning available, like on a random, I think it was like a Thursday, and we went and we were the only people in there.
Oh, nice. Yeah, so I think that's what I might do if I can't wait. I mean, it's coming to streaming next month or this month, actually.
You're almost there.
Yeah, I'm almost there. But a friend of mine at work was saying, like, you love Batman so much, you need to experience it in the theater. But
I kind of agree.
Yeah.
I kind of agree.
It's 3 hours long. That's a lot.
I was just going to say that, but it's a long time.
Yeah.
So maybe.
I'm excited to see it. However I see it, I'm sure it'll be fun. Like, I love Batman.
Yeah. Okay. So when you do watch it, you need to send me like a little...
Yeah, I'll shoot you an email and give you my review.
I want a review from you.
Okay.
Because I, without spoiling anything, it was pretty awesome.
Oh, good. Yeah, I mean, the casting is great. He looks like a great Bruce Wayne because he's got that duality down of like being like a millionaire playboy, but also this dark Avenger. It's hard. Like, you know, getting Batman right, so many people have tried. It's not as easy as it looks.
Did you like the, oh my goodness, what's his name? The previous Oh, Batman.
Ben Affleck?
No, I didn't watch that.
Christian Bale?
Yeah, did you like those?
I did. I did. My only criticism was his Batman voice was like too much almost.
It felt
Just
very
like,
cartoonish.
yeah, it was very growly, but I enjoyed those movies because they seem very like rooted in reality. Like I thought Heath Ledger was great as the Joker. Tom Hardy was a lot of fun as Bane. I liked them.
Yeah, I did too. I really like those. And this one definitely felt very akin to that,
Oh,
if that
good.
makes sense.
I
Yeah.
mean, the Michael Keaton Batman is my Batman. That was the first time there was a Batman movie, and I was like so
Right.
into that. And there's something weird about those two Tim Burton movies that hasn't been hasn't been picked up on since. Like a lot of the other movies play it completely straight, like realistic, like super realistic. And I love the weirdness of Batman and Batman Returns, like just how quirky that, like it's Tim Burton, so that's kind of what you're going to get.
Yeah.
But there's a real charm to those movies.
He was fun. Michael Keaton was super fun. He made it,
Yeah. He's a
you
great
know.
actor.
Yeah. I
Yeah.
really enjoyed his movies too, which I haven't seen in a while. I should revisit that one.
I
I
haven't
think it was.
seen the other, Batman and Robin or Batman Forever since they came out, and that's fine.
They can stay there.
Yeah, it'll be okay. Yeah.
So, any advice for future writers?
Yes. The two bits of advice I always give younger writers is finish something, like finish a story. If you want to write a novel, finish a story first or finish your draft and don't get too caught up in the ceremony of the process. And by that, I mean, like, don't have too many obstacles in your way before you like crack open your laptop and start working. Like for me, it's
Oh.
like you just open your laptop and it's there. My document's there. I'm ready to work. There's no like, I don't have to light certain candles. I don't have to listen to a certain kind of music. I don't have to be like in a certain room, like a comfy chair, like,
You don't give yourself prerequisites, like.
yeah, you don't need to like check 15 things before you can start to write because even you will never check those 15 things off. Like,
Oh my
and
God,
treat it like,
you
yeah.
just mentioned my whole life.
I'm
Like I have a
sorry.
prerequisite for everything, and I'm not a
I
writer,
do
but
too
you
for
know,
things I don't want to do.
like
If I don't want to do something, I'll put a lot of prerequisites on it.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And treat it like a job because I think a lot of writers or people that want to be writers like fantasize about it, but don't realize that there's a lot of work involved. But on the other side of that is don't feel like you have to do X or Y to consider yourself a writer. I think that's a bit of gatekeeping that exists. Like, oh, you have to write 1,000 words a day, or you have to write every day. You have to do this. You have to do that. You don't. You have to write, and you have to, we know when we're slacking. I know when I'm slacking and I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do. I don't have to hit a quota every day to feel like I'm a writer. Like the proof will be when you finish something and you publish it and it exists, then you're officially a writer, but you don't have to hit these benchmarks to feel like you're still a writer, you know?
Right. And for first-time writers approaching the whole publishing situation, do you have any tips?
Yes, I would say, celebrate the victories and don't dwell on the defeats. Like writing is a lot of rejection. Like you're going to get rejections from agents, you're going to get rejections from publishers, you're going to get rejections from, it's a ladder. You're climbing a ladder. So I think a lot of writers they'll get to one point like, oh, I got an agent, now I'm set, and your agent still needs to sell your novel, or I got a publisher, now I'm set. Your publisher still needs to, pitch your novel around, and oh, it's published, I'm set. Like there's a lot of peaks and
Yeah.
valleys. So like kind of treat it, try to keep it level, and also it doesn't have to happen in a certain order. Like I published my first book and then I got an agent, and it doesn't always
Oh,
happen in that.
wow.
Yeah, it doesn't always happen the way it happens for others. Like look at others as inspiration, as like a guide, but everyone's journey is different. So don't get down if your journey isn't as fast or as immediate as it is for some. Like some people are overnight successes. Like Secret Identity was included on this list called like Rising Star Authors, and it's my seventh novel. So you never know. You never know when you're gonna peak, I guess, or like, make it, whatever that means.
Yeah, that's a good point. And very valuable advice
Oh,
'cause
good.
it's a tough I'm sure it's a tough road, you know.
It is
You put
hard.
so
Yeah, I
much
think.
of yourself into something and then for it not to live up to your expectations, whatever those might be.
Don't engage with reviews.
Oh,
Good or bad.
yeah.
It's just
Good
like,
or bad.
one of the best bits of advice I got was like spend as much time on the good reviews as you do on the bad reviews. Like sometimes authors will get
Interesting.
a great review and they're like, oh great, where's the next one? But you get a bad review and it haunts you. It's like in your mind, you're like, oh my
Yeah.
God, what happened? So just let it go. Some authors don't even read them. don't have that discipline. I have to read them.
You read them? Well,
I don't read like Goodreads reviews. I'll read like actual reviews from like a publication or something. But
yeah,
you know, you let the bad ones slide and you let the, you savor the good ones for a minute and then you're on to the next thing.
Right. That's, yeah, that's, that makes sense. Not to take everything so seriously.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one opinion.
Exactly. Do you have any future projects that you would like to share with us?
Yes, I'm working on this comic book from NPR. National Public Radio is doing a comic book based on this obscure superhero called Microface. It's called The Mysterious Microface. It's part of the Planet Money podcast, which is their business podcast about, you know, different aspects of business and explaining it to kind of casual listeners. And I was a guest on the show. They were doing a series of episodes about comic book IP, like intellectual property, and how it's become a huge financial thing. Like you have a character in a comic book, it becomes a TV show and a movie, and that becomes really like beneficial in terms of, you know, awareness. And they found this obscure character in the public domain called Microface, and they started creating, they wanted to create a comic book to show their listeners like how a comic book comes together. And so I wrote it. Jamal Igel is the artist, and it was fun. It should be coming out in the next couple of weeks. Nice. Yeah. That'll be cool. And I'm working on the sequel to Secret Identity, which is set in the modern day.
Ooh. Oh man. Yeah, I'm not expecting that.
Yeah.
Okay. Because without spoiling it for people, there's an epilogue in the novel where you walk away very satisfied as a reader.
It picks up right after that, and it'll take you on a surprising path.
Okay. And when is this coming out?
I think end of next year, probably.
All right. I shall wait patiently.
Yeah. The galleys. I'll get you a galley.
That is
once I write it.
Super
yeah.
exciting.
Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah. I think it'll be a lot of fun. It's kind of the other side of the coin to Secret Identity.
Yeah. My mind is like trying to figure out which road could you have taken, because the book ends like, in a very nice way, as in like there aren't really any loose ends, you know. Like I said, you feel very satisfied as a reader.
That's good. Yeah,
and this, that book, you're like, okay, Carmen's okay, all's well in the world.
Yeah, that's why this is kind of like a pseudo sequel. It's not, you know, Carmen is in it, but it's not about just Carmen. Like there's another protagonist that we're kind of meeting and being introduced to. And it's about kind of how her journey overlaps with Carmen, and Carmen appears and becomes a part of the story, but it's, you know, she's in it. She's too great a character to, like, I couldn't write like a sequel and not have Carmen in it. She's also not the protagonist.
Awesome. Well, congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
I'm super excited to hear that, as I'm sure many other people are.
I hope so.
And congratulations on this book. This was,
thanks for reading.
So much fun. I know that you don't put a lot of weight into the reviews, but I will tell you, I really, really enjoyed it.
Your review carries weight. Thank you for that.
Oh no, thank you for saying that. But I think that it's a lot of people are gonna enjoy it.
I hope so.
Comic book fans, crime fiction fans, just novel fans, anybody that just wants to skate for a little while and have a fun time and really dive into a lot of, like we mentioned earlier, you have so many layers in there.
Oh, good.
That I was not expecting, to be quite honest with you. I thought it was, because it's a light read, in the sense that you can get through it quickly.
Yeah.
Without being like emotionally scarred, you know, it's not that kind of book.
That's good.
But you do, there are a lot of important layers in there that are a treat for sure.
That's good. That's good to hear.
Yeah.
I'm glad it resonated. And thanks for chatting with me.
No, it's a pleasure. I can't wait to have you back to talk about the next one. Yeah,
for sure. Consider it done.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us and for sharing your work. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And whenever you're in Miami, I would love to have you in person.
Book fair.
Yeah. Are you coming for the book fair?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. Okay. That's exciting.
We'll carve out some time.
Yeah, for sure. Well,
awesome.
Thank you again.
Thanks, Jenny.
Hope to see you soon.